Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 395 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Jeannie O.
And now, on to our read-along. We are continuing. I know no one is surprised. We are continuing A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along. So we're going to get right to it with chapter 112 entitled Oathbreaker.
It is February, I almost said 12th. No, it is not. It is February 2nd, 1776. Jamie, for all the peeps on the ridge, he calls the, all the dudes and they have like a, they have a meeting. And many of the dudes come. And it's spooky for him to think that the last time... Now, I could be wrong here, but again, speaking of A Breath of Snow and Ashes, not going back further than this book, at least. Although, it's been a while since the thing I'm about to say has happened. So, there could be something in between that I've forgotten. I do not know. I mean, actually, there is something. So, anyway, Summer can correct me or remind me or whatever. So, as Diana's writing, of course... seeing into Jamie's head or thoughts or whatever, it's spooky to think that the last time men, people, had gathered there in that reason...
Men, people?
Dudes. Humans. Had gathered there, but specifically men, had gathered there was for the reason... Basically, he's saying it was spooky to think of the last time they had gathered there and the reason for it. And my mind went straight, even though we were never part of that scene or part of that conversation... My mind went straight to, oh, when he called up people to go rescue Claire, right? But that was in chapter 24. I think something happened, and it has, right? Something has happened since then. Namely, even though Diana didn't say, oh, it's spooky to think the last time I called men to meet me here. No, he's saying the last time men had gathered. And the last time, although people had been called to by Ian and Rick, kind of rounded up. But when do you... What's the most recent thing you remember about men, anyone, people gathering there at near the door tree? She calls it like outside the door or in their front yard, basically. Most recently.
A few chapters ago when they were kidnapping Claire.
Yeah. What they meant to, they would not have called it kidnapping. They would have said, we're here to see justice prevail or whatever. And if she's innocent, so be it. She can come back, but we're going to take her to have a fair trial, whatever. So yeah, the Browns et al., mostly the Browns, had come there. Correct. And so, yeah. So when I first thought of it, I was like, oh, does Diana mean, or Jamie mean, when she was abducted, kidnapped for real, that was at the whiskey, not the still, the whiskey, the malting shed, the malting floor. Because what's her name were there? Yeah. And so, and it was not planned. The one where they came and ass demanded her to come out. That was hella planned. So yeah, it took me a second to kind of remember, oh, he's thinking about, so we never saw the scene where he went out and called the men up to go get Claire, but I assumed that was it, but no, that they didn't have time to have a gathering. They had to go save a life or more or whatever. So yeah, Jamie has received word summoning him to Wilmington to join the militias there. Who basically he asks all the people, who's going to come with me? Now, some people are shocked that he'd declared himself a rebel. So he makes like micro movements, right? There's the first time he tries to do it when he's out riding horses. Well, they only have one horse each, but they're horseback riding. He's accompanying McDonald to do something, right? And they run into Brown and a few others. And Brown, seeing McDonald in his full regalia, they're like, Fraser, you're going to get in trouble one of these days or whatever. And Fraser's like, y'all, I'm for liberty. Remember he says that? And McDonald lets him, quote unquote, lets him get away with it because he thought he was doing it under pressure, right? And then just a few chapters ago, when McDonald had come, or maybe last chapter, but McDonald had come to their home to, he had been asked, he came to ask Jamie to lead a militia, but for the government, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, remember that thing that happened that one day? He didn't say this. I'm totally paraphrasing. Remember that thing that happened that one day? And you said that you thought that I was doing it out of, you know, just to save my skin or whatever, because we were like accosted by those dudes. Yeah, no, I'm for true. I'm a reb, dude. So, and he's like, I refuse to say, I will not take hospitality from a traitor, even though.
You know, it sounds a lot less poetic when you rewrite the story.
That's okay.
Because
I don't go for poetic much.
No, I'm just saying if you were going to be a writer, I don't think you should be a writer.
If I were going to be a writer, I would not write like this. This is not writing. This is
the dudes are true. I'm a rebel.
No, I said for true, like for real, for true. You know, I've said that on accident. Now I say it sometimes on purpose, sometimes still on accident, but I've said that to you since you were kids. I would say for true.
I'm just saying is much less elegant than Diana's writing.
Of course it is. It's not meant to, the juxtaposition is supposed to be ridiculous. Okay. So he's up there, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, so who's gonna come with me? So some people, even though Jamie has like kind of slowly come out of the rebel closet, he's now like, hey,
he's full on stars and stripes now, people.
That is great. In case you don't know, woo, I'm a screaming reb. So Diana tells us, okay, some people are shocked that he declared himself rebel. And he's like, look, y'all, I have been dripping, dropping this stuff down. I have been dropping it. And you just have not picked it up. And Diana, I love her. Diana tells us her true thoughts of Myrtle Lindsay. Quote, loyal as a dog, but slow of thought. Wait, we laugh. And Jamie warns that any of them who do join him would also be declared rebels. Now, Archbug mentions the oath that so many of them swore to the king when they were either still in chains or just when they were just had been released or just had been freed, were about to be basically shipped overseas or however they were released, right? And they swore an oath to the king. But Jamie reminds them, quote, it was an oath forced upon us as captives, not one given as men of honor, unquote. In other words, it was elicited from us.
It was under duress, man.
It was not freely given as free men. Yeah. So he reminds them, then he thinks of and he reminds them of the Declaration of Arbroath, which was 400 years before, which claimed that they would never, Scots, would never be brought under English rule. And as he's quoting part of it, and as he's declaiming the oath, he comes to himself, Diana tells us, he comes face to face with his own conscience, Diana writes. And basically, he's doing this speaking to the men to try and turn them, right? You know, he needs men. So he is totally trying to convince them. Absolutely. But as he's doing this, he kind of has a come to Jesus or come to liberty moment of his own. He is realizing as he's saying this, that what he felt, and I think even Diana uses the word, or I mean, Jamie thinks it, quote unquote, but Diana's writing. I think Diana even uses the word compelled. Jamie says, even though he was never not going to be a rebel ever since his daughter and Roger Mack and Claire came back and all that. And he learns about the future and he's like, yeah, okay, of course I'm going to be a rebel. He's never not going to be a rebel once he learns of the future, right? However, Diana uses the word compelled. He never truly felt that was a free choice. He always felt, well, I got to do it. I don't have a choice. I'm going to support this country so that my daughter actually has this place. Hope, you know, I can help it exist when she's born, all of this. So, but as he's declaiming parts of this oath, he realizes that I may have been compelled before, but holy heck, I actually do believe this. And so doing that actually turns Jamie's heart as well, even though his main intent is to turn the hearts, or at least minds, of the other men so he can get more fighters. But he actually convinces himself even more. He steadies his resolve, if that makes sense. And he says, whoever's going to come with, we leave in a week. So while he only expected, at a minimum, his Ardsmuir men to likely come, Robin and Manfred McGillivray came too, and Hiram Crombie. But most surprising was Richard Brown and some 40 men that they met at the crossroads. So some men a week later came to his place and they got ready and left together. And as they left, they came to the crossroads, and at the crossroads were Richard Brown and some 40 men. And that is shocking. So Richard Brown says, if it's okay, we're going to join you. Like, Claire was not happy about it.
Right? I'm like, I don't. But he's like, we're going to let you lead us. And I'm like, I don't want you guys behind me and just shoot me in the back.
I don't want you behind me. I know what happened the last two times you tried to get near us.
How about I'm in charge, but you ride in the front of the pack.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So Claire was not happy. But Jamie's like, okay. Yes. Under me, and yes, more men are welcome. They meet another militia company later on, and once they travel on a little bit, they set up camp, and Claire begins to fill her cauldron pot, whatever. She's making some din-din, and the men are talking about the numbers they're expecting to see rebel-wise, so on their people fighting with them. Oh, and also, because it's not mentioned early on, but Ian and Roger Mack are also there too. So basically, there were talks of rebels and government troops and their relative respective numbers and potential reinforcements that might come. And it seems that the government troops, when they're speaking of the location of where other militia are and where the government troops are and where they are, that the government troops are being cut off from either side. So they're kind of being surrounded a little bit. So there's some, I guess, some sounds like, so the government troops are coming toward them, or government troops and Jamie's people are going toward each other. And there are other troops, I believe, following along behind the government troops. Diana does not write surrounded, but they're going to be cut off from either side is what she writes. So they reach the bridge, Jamie's people, dudes, and some women's. They reach the bridge at Moore's Creek the next day and join another militia company. I think it's the militia who joined them, another company. They have two small, they're called cannons, but they call them guns. They have two small guns. But the numbers of the government troops were nothing compared to the number of the rebels who were building up. So this is, Diana straight up goes there full on. Like, she's tiptoeing it or giving us, she's not tiptoeing. She's giving us huge signals now, maybe even... maybe not so much last chapter, but definitely this chapter. She's giving us huge signals or ideas of a similar. It is different because it's not the big end all battle. So that is different. But she's giving us huge signals or memories or callbacks ish to a Culloden like battle, not the Battle of Culloden, but a Culloden like battle, meaning the two sides, one basically only fighting with swords and the other, you know, much more heavily armed, even though in this case it's not tons of arms, but it's more than the government troops had, if I'm reading this correctly. So to recap, when the militias join, they have guns, as does the other side, and they have two small guns/cannons. And the numbers of the government troops whom they'll come up against, I think, in the next day, was nothing compared to the rebel militia. Jamie says, quote, the poor wee fools, the poor gallant wee fools, unquote. They were marching straight into an ambush. Now, what makes this even more Culloden, Battle of Culloden-like, is not just the inequality of the sides, as far as the numbers and the potential weapons, but also the fact that, and he says, I think, either in this chapter, or Diana writes, in this chapter or the next chapter, this is or will be the last Highland charge. So that's another thing. And Jamie says, I think, in also the next chapter, that those Highlanders will run or follow anyone whom they've given their oath to, even if it is into known death. So there's a lot to unpack for that. I'm not going to do it because it's not really a place for that, but she's giving a lot of signs. There's a lot of things that signal a Culloden-like battle as in the terms of the sides of the inequality, et cetera, and the going into it, even knowing it might be futile, right? Mm-hmm. And not turning around, et cetera. So Jamie says, or Diana writes, that they were marching straight into an ambush, which is different. Culloden was not an ambush. They were not ambushed. They were just severely overcome, right, with numbers and in both numbers and with in weaponry. A reminder, it was, because I don't think I've said his name yet. Maybe I have. But from the last chapter when MacDonald was there and he's like, I refuse to take hospitality from a traitor. But then later on when he decides he can take hospitality if it's from Roger, Roger is now fighting across from him too. So a reminder we get, it was MacDonald's own troops that Jamie and all the militia were going to fight the next day. He is a friend of theirs of some years. And that is also another signal, or whatever you want to call it, to a Culloden-like battle in that. And this is true for, more true of the American Civil War of the 19th century than the American Revolutionary War.
But there were clans that sided with the government.
Oh, yes. No, that's what I'm trying to say. So at the Battle of Culloden, it split families, not just the battle, the whole rebellion, right? Mm-hmm. For those 2 or 3 years, it split families. And the Revolutionary War, I am not a historian. I am sure there were some families that may have been split, but it was nothing like, if you're looking only at the criteria of splitting families or people from the same families fighting on different sides, that was much more a thing or much more seen, I believe, in the Jacobite Rebellion, but the 45, basically. And it was nothing like was seen, as I understand, in the American Civil War, where families also, or at least relatives, if not core families, like maybe not immediate family members, but definitely relatives, right, fought on different sides. So that, and that was, you know, much more understandable as far as, you know, this country had been around a little longer. There were more people who were intertwined and related. So it just kind of makes more sense, even just given a longer time frame of existence. So it was MacDonald's troops that they were going to come against the next day. And like I said, there's that bridge. I believe it's called the Battle of the next day. The next battle is the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge, they call it. Anyway, so Jamie's militia, they cross the bridge and they start to set up camp. And also they begin to dismantle the bridge. So between this chapter and the next chapter, when we get a little more description of it, it sounds like they are dismantling the floorboards, but the floor planks, the planks you'd be walking across, right? And mm-hmm. and I'm sure some other stuff, but there was enough of a bridge left, meaning some of its frame. Maybe it's just the part of the frame that's connected to the land on the other side. I don't know. But in the next chapter, you'll see that they like wipe it. They grease it up with tallow to make it like you can't hold on to it. So like they give them no option of safety, right? They want to cut off all protection to them. So so when she said that they dismantled the bridge, but there was something left to put, there was some wood left to put tallow on, and it wasn't the floorboards that they threw over the over the side, because who cares about that? So we don't know what that looks like, or I don't know what that looks like, but they definitely made it uncrossable, unusable. And someone asks, wouldn't the troops see that the bridge is out? And Jamie says, not if the fog lasts till morning, and it will, unquote. And toward the end of the chapter, Jamie gets a very strong feeling of Murta, the ghost of Murta, being there with him, which of course means that Murta is there with him, and because he was his protector.
Moving right along to chapter 113, entitled The Ghosts of Culloden.
By dawn the next morning, the men are standing in wait, and they can hear the sounds of the army approaching. So the army approaching would have found the deserted campfires and known that Jamie, the other militias, etc., their enemy, was across the creek. But they also note that there is no bridge. And this is where I was saying, the men, the militia, Jamie's militia and other rebels, had even greased the support timbers. So this is what I meant by, like, I don't know if it's the frame of the bridge, that like the outer sides of where those floorboards would be connected to on the other side. I don't know. But I can only imagine a bridge frame. Who knows? And, or it could be a support timber. That could be the stuff that's not drilled, but driven into the bottom of the body of water. Mm-hmm. And they're sticking up straight out of it. Those are, maybe that's it. That makes more sense. So if someone's crossing a bridge, they can grab onto a pole or whatever to kind of steady themselves. If they tallowed those up, oh, good Lord, like you have nothing to gain purchase on, right? You have nothing to hold on to help you. Yeah. So that's probably it. And they hear what seems like they'll be charging the creek. And Roger is like shocked. He's like, that's freaking suicide. Like that's like, they can't do that. That they have to know that that's like, there's no way out of that. And one apparently also on the side of the militia, the rebels, there is one Colonel Lillington. He recognizes Jamie and demands to know what side he's on. Jamie's all, what side of the creek do you see me on, dude?
Exactly.
I mean, you don't have to ask stupid questions. You're going to get a stupid answer.
Literally couldn't be more clear.
Really, truly. So this is where the phrase, the last Highland charge. So the last Highland charge is beginning. So as the government troops are coming up, Jamie's, the rebels, fire upon the government troops just before they reach the frame of the bridge. Cannon is shot and they fire again and again. Jamie sees Alan MacDonald, Flora MacDonald's husband, and Major MacDonald. So Alan MacDonald, Flora's husband, and Major MacDonald, the dude who has been their friend, are coming up with this charge. And he notes that the major was wounded and he was struck again. And the major, he's in the water now and he falls. He rises again and he falls and he rises again. And Jamie's like, I got to put this dude out of his misery. It is not fair. This is torture.
He was shot in like the face. Like it was like multiple times. Like he had his jaw was hanging off when he stood up that last time.
Yeah,
and then they
gross.
Finally shot him in the neck. I was just like, geez.
Get it over with. Yeah. He is your friend at the end of the day and is human. Like you don't want anyone to suffer like that. And the battle was over in minutes. And right after this, Diana is writing this. Jamie has visions or memories, both, of Culloden, the Battle of Culloden. And he has visions of Jack Randall. I think we're to believe, because in the books, right, he does not talk a lot about it. He does not remember. He's blocked a lot of it out. Little by little, over time, things do come back to him. And I believe this is the first time we get this scene in the books, in that he's seeing Jack Randall, and he realizes that although it hadn't killed him, Murta, before either of them, well, Jamie didn't die, obviously, but before Jamie was severely injured in his thigh and before Randall was killed, Murta had tried to strike Jack Randall. But Randall had heard or sensed him at the last minute and he spun and Murta missed his blow, he turned just in time. But all of that to say, Murta had come to save him. That's what he remembers. So this aligns nicely with the end of the previous chapter when Diana describes that Jamie is feeling the presence of Murta. And then we get this memory of his. Not only do we know that Murta swore to as his godfather, right, swore to protect him in general in life. He did that up till his very end. And he's getting this kind of, I don't want to call it a blessing. Sure, I guess you could say it's a blessing to have another memory of someone you loved, right? It's never bad, or usually not going to be bad. But it just is that, I don't know. It's probably bittersweet to know that he had tried to save him. Because to him, right, all this whole BJR thing, like how he ended up dead, laying on him, all this, like it's a huge blank. It's a huge blank. And now a tiny piece of that motion picture in his mind of memory, a tiny piece has been put back in. And it's still not complete in the books. But a little piece has come back in. And Roger makes sure, he's like, Roger asks Jamie, are you okay? Are you injured? And Jamie's like, I'm all good. And then Roger goes off to tend the dying and bless the dead.
And that was chapter 113. We are starting the 12th and final part of A Breath of Snow and Ashes. Part 12 entitled, Time Will Not Be Ours Forever. With chapter 114 entitled Amanda.
And I thought, well, that was quick. We suddenly have a name. So another article from Loignon dated May 15th, 1776. So it's a few months after the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge. And basically, to summarize the important points of that article or that, whatever you call it, it memorializes the victory at Moore's Creek Bridge. It says, Neil Forbes is missing stuff. His home had been broken into, or his office, or whatever that place was. And we have a birth announcement. Quote, born to Captain Roger Mackenzie of Fraser's Ridge and his lady, a girl, on the 21st of April, same year, 1776. Child and mother are reported in good health. The child's name is given as Amanda Claire Hope Mackenzie. Unquote. So we have a Mandy. That was nice to read about because we've read it. We know about Mandy. We've read the, you know, beats. Like, we know about Mandy. But every time I come to this chapter, it always makes me tear up because not just the joy of having a baby, but like as soon as you have this blessing,
Roger got
it's like
to be there.
I mean, I'm not even talking about that. Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, no, but you're right. You're right. I forgot that part. My point is everything that comes with the joy of a baby, right? Roger's there. He knows it's his.
Right. I know.
Sure,
and I bet
sure.
that this went a long way in probably healing Bree and Roger.
And then as soon as they find that out, well, not as soon as, but pretty soon after this huge joy and blessing and all this stuff from this new baby, they find out she has a life-threatening condition.
Yeah.
And
the joy was
leave.
Kind of short-lived.
Yeah. So, of course, Claire has to ruin everything.
I mean, Claire didn't ruin it. They made it.
Well, that's true. But Claire has to bring down the house. No, that's a good thing. Claire has to harsh their mellow. Is that better? Mandy has a heart condition.
Yeah.
And Claire, even though she hears it and she knows with her expertise and her length, well, time in service, her... Not just her knowledge, but the years she's worked in medicine, she trusts her gut. But even though she knows to trust her gut, she still is trying to, and understandably, second guess herself, like maybe I could be wrong. Like maybe, because that would be the difference of everything, right? That would mean everything if I'm wrong. But as Claire is once again listening to the sound of what she is diagnosed as a patent ductus arteriosus, she says, quote, don't let it be bad. Don't let it be bad. And as she says it, she opens her eyes and Brianna is standing there. And Bri herself says she knew something was wrong because Mandy wasn't eating as much as Jem did. And also they describe her nails or her nail beds as faintly tinged blue. So what's to be done? Brianna asks point blank if she'll die. And Claire nods after Bri says, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And for once, I mean, yeah, there's more than one occasion. I'm not saying this is the only time ever. But as far as things that have come to them and their wee family, like Jamie, his kids, Roger, all that, like their immediate family, this is the first time that she cannot fix it.
I mean, she couldn't fix Henri Christian either.
That was a little bit different.
I mean, they're both birth defects, right?
But hers can be cured. His was not going to be cured. So hers may or may not have been a genetic thing, but right, it was something that could be. Hers was a fault.
She couldn't do either anything about either of them. They're both grandchildren.
Yeah, but Henri's wasn't going to kill him. This was going to kill her. So it's something that was going to kill someone she loved, and she could not do anything about it. And I just said kill, but that kills her. Like that, imagine being Claire, like not being able to help. And here she is, like her greatest, besides she loves them. They would love her just as much if she weren't a doctor, right? If she weren't a healer. But here she is, you know, known far and wide as this wonderful healer, and she can't help her own granddaughter. So she feels very impotent, I'm sure. And so there really is no choice. They must go back. That's the only way to save, for a possibility to save Mandy. Claire says that the operation is actually quite simple. It's a simple modern operation, but is no way it can be done here. Quote. And this gave me, I'm not going to use the word I said yesterday when we were recording something else. I forget what it was. I think I said nose Pringle.
You did say nose Pringle.
I almost said nose Pringle again. So I got it. This brings me a tear prick and actual tears. Quote. And so they had begun to discuss the unthinkable, because there were choices and decisions to be made. But the unalterable basic fact was clear. Amanda must go through the stones if she could. Unquote. So now they're on a mission to see if she can.
Yeah, this is when Jem turns into the creepy kid in Sixth Sense.
Yeah. Jamie tries with his father's ruby ring. Now, baby Mandy seems interested in it, but as Claire says, it could just be a kid. Any kid is interested in something bright and shiny, right? So, you know, it's not proof. And then Claire, they're like, okay, well, what else can we try? And they get the raw sapphire out of Claire's little, what is she, the thing she wears, her talisman.
Like her, yeah.
Yeah, her little pouch. So they get this raw sapphire out of Claire's pouch. And Mandy turns her head toward the sapphire. And they're all, where's Jem, by the way? And yeah, he had been left in Jamie's study, and he got a hold of a book called Fanny Hill, which is probably a naughty book for a kid his age. And he was spelling out, well, not like naughty words, but words that they didn't probably want him to know. But yes, the word was phallus.
I thought it was weird that he was like, it's another name for prick, but don't you go saying it. So I'm like, wait, so you're cool with him saying prick, but not phallus?
Apparently, they said prick all over the last few books. So apparently prick is not a bad word in that time. But phallus, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's more educated. And then if you used it, they'd be like, oh my goodness, who have you, what have you been into? Basically, I don't know. So she seems to like the bright and shiny of the ruby ring. She turns her head towards Claire's raw sapphire. And once they bring Jem in from the naughty book, they ask him, look, dude, can your sister hear the stone? Oh, sorry. Can he hear the stone? And he says, sure, it sings. When asked if Mandy can hear it, he says, she can hear it. And they're all, how do you know? And he says, she says so.
I see dead people.
That's a creepster. We love us some Jem. But that's a creepster. Whew. And now who should go? So obviously Amanda and Bree. Amanda cannot take herself there. And she's nursing, however much she is nursing. So it's got to be Amanda and Bree. But the others. And they decide, like, Roger's like, I don't want you to leave without me. And like, well, if you come with me, how do we leave Jem? And Claire's like, okay, we just need to get two more stones just in case. Like, we'll have this conversation at the stones. Right now, we need to prepare in case y'all do need to go. So in June, which was... So she's born in May, so it was the next month. So in June, they go down the mountain for this purpose. I'll be coming down the mountain for some stones. I'll be coming down the mountain for some stones. Help me finish this. We'll be coming down the mountain, coming. We'll be coming down the mountain. We'll be coming down the mountain for some stones. Okay, I can't make it sound like I can't add anything to it. Okay.
No. Moving on. Right along to chapter 115, entitled Nose Picker.
I wonder if Diana got tired here and just like, she's like, I don't have anything cute or
I mean, that's
poetic.
It's a very prominent thing in the chapter.
I know that. I didn't say it wasn't relevant. I'm like, I wonder if she got bored here. It's funny. It is funny, but it's not elegant. And even her funny stuff is usually a little more erudite. A little higher level. This is lowbrow.
Lowbrow.
And I love it. Whenever I hear lowbrow, I think Löwenbräu. Okay. The date is July 4th, 1776. So Mandy is what now? May, June, July. She's not quite 2 months old. So they've all come down the mountain where they came in Wilmington. I think they said Wilmington. Anyway, they are in Wilmington, I think. So it's July 4th, 1776. They're staying in an inn together. Claire is there with Mandy, and she's having second and third and fourth thoughts about her diagnosis and wondering, maybe I'm wrong. Or what if Mandy can't go through the stones? Well, she knows she's not wrong, but she has a very legitimate fear or worry about what if Mandy can't go through, then she's definitely condemned to death, right? Mia R. writes, I can feel Claire's sense of frustration as she imagines performing the intricate surgery on her granddaughter. If she only, quote, had a proper operating suite, the blood transfusions, the calibrated and carefully administered anesthesia, the oxygen mask, the swift trained nurses. Yeah, unquote. Yeah, that ain't happening, Mia R. Mm-mm-mm. That's a little bit much. It's a lot bit much.
I think that's the point.
Exactly. I know that, of course. Jamie and Ian arrive from wherever they had gone to. And apparently they had gone off to get fish because they come back with some fish and some other things. Ian enters the inn room where they're staying with his finger up his nose. Now, while they're regaling Claire with their stories of their outing about getting into fights and who punched who and how they didn't get punched and how the other guys did, they also, I think they're mostly talking about the fights and the fish. And then when she's like, what the hell's up with your nose, dude? And she goes, take your finger out of your freaking nose.
She's like, I've had enough of you.
Yes, enough. I can't take you seriously with telling me how you got into a fight with your finger stuck up your nose, you little, or not so little, 20-something-year-old dude. But apparently, something was supposed to come out of his nose. He says he was holding something in there. So he removes his finger, and he looks at his uncle, and he's like, Uncle Jamie is stuck. And so Claire's like, okay, fine. I can go get my little forceps and I can get it out. And Ian's freaked. Like, I don't want her going up my nose to my brain. Jamie says he has a better idea. Goes downstairs, gets someone's snuff box and brings it up. And Ian is like, oh, thank goodness. Ian takes a little bit of the stuff, inhales it, sneezes and blows down the inn. I'm just kidding. He blows out a gem. It was called the type of gem. It was a chrysoberyl. I think that's the correct pronunciation. Now, how did they get this chrysoberyl? They stole it from Neil Forbes. So remember back in the quote in the Loignon about how, or the little description of how Neil Forbes had been robbed, like someone had broken into his, I guess, office or something, or his home. Yeah. So that happened. That was not them, but that happened. And they thought about Neil Forbes and maybe trying, seeing what they could do. And when they went there, they saw that while he wasn't home, they could tell where someone had broken in. And it had like a canvas or a tarp nailed over it. Like that's going to keep anybody out. So they went inside, saw this gem just sitting on this box, and they took it. And because they heard a watchman or somebody coming, he's like, whatever, shoved it up his nose. Like,
that's the first thought. No.
My first thought probably would be swallowing it, but you got to wait a lot longer and that's a lot messier. But I don't know. I'd hopefully have a pocket.
I was going to say, I'm like, oh, don't pants have pockets?
Look, he has something to carry that ear around in. He's still got to have something. And also, where's Rollo? He's got to be here somewhere. Not that you give Rollo the
I'm like, what's Rollo going to do with it?
No, but Rollo, like, surely they didn't leave Rollo. I mean, I don't think that they would not have left him at the ridge, but I'm not suggesting Rollo has any part in hiding the gem, because then who knows when they would get it back, because he goes poop everywhere probably. With the chrysoberyl, or chrysoberyl, however it's pronounced, they now have three gems. We still need one. And Mia R. closes us out with the scene of amusement changing to panic as Ian cannot extract the gem that they had, quote unquote, ransomed from a wee box on Forbes' desk, very conveniently, and they discovered as they were running away from the Chatter Society. So the Chatter Society, I think, is where they got into that fight with the fish and everything. Apparently, Ian had decided to hide the gem in his nose when they heard a watchman coming. This gem will serve the Mackenzies as they make their way back through the stones to attempt to save Mandy's life. At least that's the intent. We again get a reminder of a foreshadowing of Wee Amanda's powers as Jamie bends over her basket holding the chrysoberyl. So this new stone, this is now the third stone that's been held over Mandy, right? We get a reminder and a foreshadowing of Wee Amanda's powers as Jamie bends over the basket holding the chrysoberyl. Even while sleeping, quote, a tiny fist rose through the netting, fingers flexing as they grasped at the stone. Unquote.
And that was chapter 115.
Again, a special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Jeannie O.
And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, please do at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And if you're interested in having any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can find that at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't joined our text community, why not? It's free. Text hello or something like that, to 916-659-5112. And thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code Outlander20, Outlander20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Outlander Pod.
It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from 2 closet finishes and 4 colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now. Save big.